That brings us to our speaker. Our speaker tonight is Janice. She comes to us from Union, New Jersey, and I believe she's going to sit tonight because she has something wrong with her leg. So she's going to sit in the chair and help me welcome Janice. Hi, everybody. I'm Janice. I am a recovered alcoholic. And this is a new injury, so when I speak, I usually like to stand. I don't know how it's going to go. If I need to sit, I'll lift this thing off and sit, so be patient. We'll see how it goes. My home group is a Vision for You group in Union, New Jersey. We are a solution-based group. We focus on a step a week, and we invite speakers to come in and speak on a certain step, and then we open up for discussion. I live about 45 minutes away from my home group, but that's where I found a solution. So I am an active member of my home group. And, you know, I'm lucky enough to be invited to travel and speak a little bit, and I have to admit, this is one of the coolest places I've ever spoken. So, I mean, how great is this? It's probably the last smoking meeting I've ever seen. But speaking outside in the middle of a cornfield is pretty cool. Except the fact that the last, like, 15 minutes of my drive, I was begging for a gas station or Dunkin' Donuts or anything with a facility. So, I had no idea. We're in the middle of nowhere, and it's just gorgeous here. So thanks for inviting me. I do identify myself as a recovered alcoholic. Anything less would be falsely humble. I do not consider myself cured, nor will I ever be cured of this disease. But knowing what I know about alcoholism today, the obsession of the mind, the physical craving, I no longer suffer from the manifestations of alcoholism today in my life. And that's only the direct result of doing the work in the book. And I've had various periods of sobriety where I was a meeting maker and I was sober for years and I ended up not making it. I had another period of sobriety where I worked the steps, rested on my laurels, and went back out. So I bring a breadth of experience both in and out of the rooms in this program, working it, trying it to work it my way, and working it the way it's supposed to be worked, and continuing to work it in my life and practicing the principles of recovery in my life on a daily basis. You know, it's funny, when I do travel to speak, God has this way of showing up in my life and throwing something at me, like a good week before I have to go speak somewhere. And what that does is it, you know, enables me to bring a new experience, you know, because I'm going through something and I'm writing inventory and speaking with others, and, you know, this was a big one. This was a big injury. And I always know God's going to throw something at me, but I never expected this. And this blindsided me. But, you know, like I was sharing with Brian over here, you know, whatever God brings me to, God will bring me through. And I know that from experience. I fancy myself an athlete. I play a lot of sports, and I tore my ACL on Monday night a week ago. And I'm facing a really big surgery. And I know that from experience, again, because I tore my ACL in my other knee about 4 years ago. So I know what I'm looking at, and it's a heart surgery, it's a tough recovery, and, you know, for right now I can't play ball. And I know that sounds really trite to a lot of people, but it's, you know, it's really hard for me. Playing ball is what I do, and it's a big part of my life, and God's got other plans for me right now. And I've written a whole lot of inventory in the past week. And what, you know, I started out writing resentment inventory, and I had no idea what I was resentful at. It wasn't God, because I trust. I really do trust today that whatever I'm being brought through, I'm going to come out in a better place as a result of it. And I know that today. So I wasn't mad at God. I wasn't mad at myself. I wasn't mad at my husband. I wasn't mad at my kid. I had no idea what I was mad at, but I was mad. I was pissed. So I wrote inventory just on being pissed. I didn't know who it was at or what it was about, but I was angry. And I shared it with my sponsor, and was directed to write a whole bunch of other inventory, mostly peer inventory. You know, I'm grateful because I do believe that I have the best sponsor in the world. And I'm here to tell you that if you don't think you have the best sponsor in the world, then you should get a new sponsor. I've had a bunch of sponsors, and every single sponsor I've had was the exact right sponsor for me at that moment. And right now I have the best sponsor in the world. And I thank God for my sponsor. I have used every substance known to man. I identify myself as an alcoholic because I always respect the room that I'm in. But just for, you know, if there's anybody out there that sometimes feel that they don't belong in AA, I've used every single substance there is to use. And I've abused everything that I've ever used. So if you wonder if you belong here, you do. I've gone to other fellowships, but I have found my home and my recovery in AA. And I respect the home that I'm in. As I hear many people say from the podium, I believe I was a full-blown alcoholic before I ever took a drink. I was all over page 52. I was having trouble in every area of my life. And my first spiritual experience was the result of alcohol at age 14, I'm guessing. Alcohol fixed it. Alcohol fixed me. Alcohol fixed everything that's on page 52. My relationships got better. I was prettier. I was happier. It fixed the spiritual malady that I had my whole life growing up. And I think most of you understand when I say it fixed it. You know what it is. And alcohol fixed it for me. I went away to college and I started doing a whole host of other things and traveling around the country. My second spiritual experience was the result of following the Grateful Dead around the country. That was my second spiritual experience. And taking a whole host of other chemicals to get there. And then at the age of 18, I was on a beach in Mexico, and there was this photographer, and yada, 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 I ended up in the world of modeling. Through no pursuit of my own. This is nothing I ever set out to do. And next thing I know, I'm with an agency, and I'm traveling, and I'm on magazines, and it was a really bizarre world to be thrown into. Completely insecure, no sense of self, no self-esteem, and I'm thrown into this world that's not a hotbed of spirituality. And I got sicker and sicker and sicker. And what alcohol fixed for me, you know, here and there, I was ingesting something every day around the clock at some point. I'd wake up, I'd get loaded, I'd go to work, I get loaded at work, I get loaded after work, and I missed a lot of work. You know, a lot of the stuff that, like I said, I was addicted to a whole bunch of stuff, and a lot of the stuff that I needed, you know, I couldn't buy at a store. So I'd be going, I was living in New York City, and I'd be going to the Lower East Side of New York City, and, you know, the people I needed to see weren't always on time, and I had to sit around, and I got real sick, and I remember, you know, Flacco doesn't keep regular hours. But, you know, I remember vividly there was a fashion show I was supposed to be doing, and I'm, you know, I can't go anywhere until I have what I need. That's just my life. I can't go anywhere. I was very physically sick if I didn't have what I needed, so I'd wait. You know, figure everyone waits for me, and I'd show up late, and I'd miss my pass on the runway, I'd get fired, and, you know, go on my day. I'd be in the makeup chair so loaded I couldn't hold my head up. They'd call my agency, and they'd come collect Janice. You know, people would call, what's wrong with Janice? But I was making money, so they, you know, they kind of let it go. Then I got arrested, and things changed. I spent a couple nights in jail, and I was with Ford at the time, and Eileen Ford called me and fired me. Talked myself out of it, as we're good at doing, manipulated. I was in the wrong place at the wrong time, wasn't me, yada, 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 and I got my job back. But in the realm of all this, I started going, my agency did their first intervention on me, and I went reluctantly to my first rehab in Minnesota. I spent a lot of time in Minnesota, and usually not willingly. I went to my first treatment center, I'd say in 1987, I'm guessing. I spent 28 days there, and as I was leaving the rehab to get on a plane back to New York City, you know, I still had my little plastic bracelet on, I'm crossing the road, I'm going to a little mini mart to buy beer. Because I didn't think alcohol was really my problem. And, you know, the guy at the counter is just laughing at me because he sees my little plastic bracelet, and I'm sure I'm not the first one with the plastic bracelet on buying booze. But I went back to New York City, and, you know, I was loaded for I don't even know how long. But I was purely, I didn't know any differently, but I was purely convinced that this was a physical disease, that if I could successfully detox myself, that I would be okay. I used to look at people on the street. I always wanted the Keith Richards cure. If I could get a blood transfusion and physically be detoxed of all my substances, that's all I needed to do. So I would detox myself in various ways. I had to travel a lot for my job. So I'd get on a plane for, you know, a couple weeks, wherever it was we were shooting, and I'd be loaded with stuff to help me detox. And I'd arrive wherever we were, and at the end of a week or 2 weeks, I was successfully detoxed. I'd get on a plane, I'd land back at JFK, suitcases in hand, taxi straight to get loaded, without a second thought. The physical need was no longer there. I was no longer living in the physical craving because I was detoxed. I didn't need to put anything in my body anymore. But I had never, ever gotten rid of the mental obsession. And it was with me from the first time I ever took a drink. And I just didn't know about it then. So, you know, I detoxed myself so many times I can't count. I've spent, I don't even know how many rehabs I've been in, how many detox facilities I've been in, a lot. Another one of my cures was I would leave the country every September. And I would go to another country, figuring, you know, I'll go somewhere where I can't find what I need. And, you know, that didn't work either. I would go out of the country from September through Christmas every year to work. And wherever it was, I would find what I wanted. Paris, Milan, Tokyo, Sydney, whatever it was, except for one country. Oh, and then another thing I would do, this is how good we are at manipulation and getting what we want. Wherever it was I would land, I would call the hotline and I'd go to a fellowship. You know, they'd come pick me up, so I didn't know where I was, and they'd come pick me up, bring me to a meeting, and I'd sit in the meeting long enough to find out what part of town it is that I should not be going to. And then I'd get up and leave and go there. And then that's how I existed for the next 3 months. There was one country where I couldn't get a lot of the other substances that I like, and that was I went to Japan. And thusly, in Japan, I drank round the clock, from the moment I got up to the moment I passed out at night. And in Japan, they don't have soda machines on the street. They have sake machines on the street. So at 7 o'clock in the morning, I'm shuffling down to the sidewalk in my slippers with yen in my hands, pumping yen into the sake machine. They flip me out a little can. I hold my nose, and I throw that back at 7 in the morning. And that's how I got through Japan. I went, you know, right back in New York. I don't know how long I lasted. Went to another treatment facility back in Minnesota, different facility, but still back in Minnesota. And I always went to Minnesota in the middle of winter. Don't ask me why. It was always December, and it's really cold in Minnesota, like really, really cold, like unbearably cold. Like I had to wear goggles to walk my dog cold. And I went through a few treatment centers there. And they would say, you know, we really think that you need to go to this halfway house in Duluth. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Duluth, Minnesota. You know, my ego was so big that I'm like, I'm not going to Duluth, Minnesota. You know, don't you know who I am? And I really was nobody. But I thought I was. So I never did what they thought I should do because I always thought I could manage better. I ended up going back out there again, desperate, and I was willing to do whatever they told me to do, whatever they do. Wherever you wanted me to go, I'll go. And I ended up in a halfway house in St. Paul, where I stayed for 3 months, and then got kicked out for getting loaded. But in the course of that, I had made a lot of friends in the program that had actually stayed sober. I did not. My lowest bottom came, I moved to Chicago looking for work, and in the course of about 2 weeks, I overdosed, and I was with a woman, and I hit the floor. And she was an aerobics instructor, so she knew CPR. And if it wasn't for her and being an aerobics instructor and knowing CPR, I wouldn't be standing here today. She pumped my chest, brought me back. The minute I woke up, the minute my eyes opened, I said, "Where is it?" You know, death didn't scare me. I just wanted more. A few days after that, I went to the part of town that I shouldn't be going in Chicago, and four guys came up to me with a gun. Pointed at my chest, they put a gun at my chest and said, "Give me all your money." And I said no. It's so great I can laugh about this today. You know, that tells you that I needed to get loaded more than I valued my life. They pistol whipped me, left me for dead in a tenement in Chicago. I was unconscious in a pool of my own blood, bleeding to death. I came to, they'd stolen everything. I mean, I'm lucky that's all that happened. They stole every possession I had, and I crawled out to the street and flagged down a mailman who took me to the ER, and they stitched my head up. But that wasn't enough. A few days later, I was in the ER again, and I had this infection. I had a really, really high fever. They didn't know what was wrong with me. I didn't know what was wrong with me. I had a rash all over my body. I was just really sick, and they admitted me. They called my family. I grew up in northern Jersey. They called my family, and they said, "We have your daughter, and we don't think she's going to live out the week. We don't think she's going to make it." And nobody came. I wrote a lot of inventory on that one. But I get it today. I really understand it today, and I have a great relationship with my family today. But they were done with me, and they had told me about a year prior to that, "Don't ever, ever call us again until you're sober." But understand, I had not been relying on my family financially since I had been like 18, and I'm guessing I was about 27 at this point. But emotionally, I had nowhere else to go. So when I was in trouble emotionally, I called my family, and they were done. "Don't ever call me again until you're sober." So when they called them and said, "Your daughter's dying," they were just waiting to pick up my body for years. Anyway, I went back to Minnesota where I said I had some friends. Back to Minnesota. I had a lot of friends that had managed to stay sober, and I started going to meetings. And this one guy said to me, "If you want to get sober, you'll call this woman." And so I called her. I drove up to her house in Ham Lake, Minnesota. Another blow to my ego. Ham Lake. God has a really funny sense of humor when it comes to my ego. So I drove up to Ham Lake, Minnesota, and, you know, this woman, God bless her, she said, "I think you need to stay here with me for a while." You know, and it was her and her husband, and I think she had 3 or 4 kids, young children. And she didn't know me, you know, and I was basically, you know, a homeless bum from the street. She had no reason to trust me, no reason to care. And without a second thought, she said, "You need to come stay with us for a while." And I didn't leave for about 4 months, and that woman saved my life. She had me going through the big book, and she had me saying the third step prayer on my knees every morning. I didn't get it. I didn't know why I had to do it. I didn't understand the prayer. I just did it. Like I said, I was willing to do anything. I moved back to St. Paul, and I had a lot of sober friends, and I was going to a lot of AA meetings. And I was, you know, I was a meeting maker, and I was making it. You know, I went back to graduate school, and my life got better, and I was sober for the first time in however, and I had relief. I had genuine relief. I wasn't struggling every day, and I wasn't miserable every day, and I wasn't, you know, pray to everybody else every day. And my externals got better. Internally, you know, not so much. I never really treated my internal condition. I didn't know any differently. I didn't know the difference that I know today between relief and freedom. And I thought that all AA had to offer me was relief. And I thought that was enough. After about 4 years in AA, you know, I was in graduate school, I got a great job, and, you know, I didn't make the decision, but I just slowly stopped going. My life got real busy, thank you. And I just stopped going, running my own life and doing okay, so I thought. And I existed that way for another 3 years or so. And then I suffered an injury, playing softball. And went to the ER, they gave me some pain medication, and I was off. I was off for years. I moved back to New Jersey. I got married, and I moved back to New Jersey with my husband, still in active alcoholism. And I entered, God willing, my last detox facility in January of 2003. With a horrible addiction to alcohol and other things. And when I was released, I was only in there for 4 days, and I was really, really physically sick. And when they released me, I was still very physically sick. And my husband had actually, he is also an alcoholic, and he had actually relapsed. And he went to detox the week before I did. And the way that God orchestrated everything that went on when we left was amazing. God put this person in his life to sponsor him, and put this woman in my life, and I called her up, and I was still shaken, and she's like, if you want to get sober, you're going to meet me at this meeting tonight, and I did not want to go. I was shaking, I was crying, I was sweating, I was puking, but I went, and I sat in that chair crying and sweating, and I was miserable, but I went, and all of a sudden, I started hearing a message of recovery that I had never, ever heard in AA, ever, in those years that I was going to meetings in Minnesota. When I was living in Minnesota, I was going to step meetings and never, ever worked a step, ever. We would talk about the steps. We would read in the 12 and 12. I had a sponsor. We'd go out for coffee. But no one ever told me that I had to work these steps or how to work these steps. You know, go figure. But that's just the way it was. And all of a sudden, I'm sitting in this room with people on this path, and my spirit could not deny what I was seeing. People like on fire in this work. People happy and at peace and talking about recovery and doing the steps and having these experiences, and I wanted that. I just didn't know how to get it. So, you know, a sponsor started taking me through the work really quickly. And that's the way I take women through the work, pretty quickly. You know, how, and that's what they said to me, how soon do you want to get free? You know? When you start, and as my sponsor will say, when people will ask him, you know, when should I start working the steps? As soon as you stop puking, you're late. That's my sponsor. And yeah, I have a guy sponsor. And I thank God for that every day. And I never intended it to be that way. That's just who God put in my life at that time. I sought out a lot of women. And they said no. And then I went back to this person and, you know, gratefully he said yes. And I hit him at the right time because he does not sponsor women. And he does a lot of workshops and he speaks all over the world. And I guess he was getting deluged with requests. And his sponsor said, take two women through the work. And I just showed up at the right time, so I'm grateful for that. But I do not sponsor men, and I wouldn't suggest anybody having an opposite sex sponsor. That's not what I'm advocating. It's just, like I said, that's the way God showed up in my life, and I'm grateful for it. So I started going through this work. And I started changing internally. Externally, my life got worse. Internally, my life got better. I went through 8.5 steps. And then I started sponsoring women. So I went from 8.5 to 12. So you can guess where I'm going with this. I started on fire, you know, making my amends. And my amends process has always been fantastic. I've never had an amends go wrong, and I've heard some stories, but I've been very lucky. My amends were just amazing, and I was on fire. And you know how it says in our book that we will be amazed before we are halfway through? I was. I was amazed. Before I was halfway through, so I stopped making my amends. You know, all the really hard ones, I don't really have to do this, I'm okay. And I never made them. I never finished my amends process. I had no daily inventory. I had no prayer meditation practice, and I started sponsoring women. So I went from 8.5 to 12. With a whole lot of knowledge of this book, and I could quote you the book inside and out, and I knew the steps, and I knew the work, and knowledge did not serve me. Knowledge did not keep me sober. You know, like it says in our book, self-knowledge is not enough for me. I was a prey to that knowledge. I was a prey to sounding good in meetings and all that ego crap. So I was sponsoring women, and I ended up moving to where I live now, about an hour south of where I am. And I was doing really well. But when I moved, all my women had to find new sponsors because I was too far away. So, you know, they found their way, and I moved, and I started trying to go to meetings where I had moved to, and I wasn't hearing this message of recovery. I wasn't hearing the solution. I was going to meetings, and I was hearing the problem. And I'd raise my hand, and I'd try to share the solution, and nobody wanted to hear what I had to say, and I copped a resentment, and I was really spiritually arrogant, and I ended up, you know, not going. I backed myself right out of AA once again. And where at one point in my recovery, I was absolutely living in all three sides of the triangle. Absolutely, equally, every day of my life. One by one, each side of the triangle fell off. I had absolutely no connection with God. That was the first thing that goes. Any kind of spiritual program that I had was gone. I was not being of service. I wasn't sponsoring anybody or working with anybody new. And I certainly wasn't working any steps. So, you know, when the triangle's gone, what's left? I was left with a huge gaping hole once again. And I survived like that for maybe 9 months. And then the fateful day came. And as they say in Jim or Fred's story, and I don't remember which one, suddenly showed up. It was a beautiful day. I had no problems. You know, everything in my life was just fine. And suddenly showed up. I'm driving home from a softball game, and I think I had hurt my pinky. And I thought, you know, if I go to the ER, I was loaded within a half hour. I don't remember the decision. I believe the decision was made for me. The thought crossed my mind. I had absolutely no mental defense against the first drink. None. Thought crossed my mind. I was in the obsession immediately, loaded within a half hour. With all this knowledge about alcoholism, all the book knowledge I had, all the experience I had, meaningless. Because I had no mental defense at that point. I had absolutely no spiritual program. Leveled, once again, leveled. Came crawling back to the room. But I must say that, you know, once again I tried to manage it. You know, I tried various ways of stopping, and, you know, we all know how that goes. But I actually refused to get on my knees and ask God for help because I knew if I did, I'd end up back in these rooms or another facility or another detox or wherever it was, and I just didn't want to do that. So I tried every single possible way I could to manage this, and I couldn't. I couldn't get on some people. I'd go to meetings and say I had a week or whatever it was, and I could not stop on my own. I had absolutely no power. You know, lack of power is my dilemma. With power, no dilemma. I had no power. I was powerless. So, I finally got on my knees, leveled, and cried and asked for help. I called my old sponsor who just didn't know what to do with me, and she asked me to call this person who's my sponsor today. And he said, I want you to go see this woman and this woman and this woman. And I did whatever I was told, and I went to them, and they said no, and I went back. And she's like, all right, let's go. and we started the work. And I've known him for years, and he's known my story. And the first thing he said to me was, my job is to get you dependent on God and independent of me as soon as possible. And if you know my sponsor, that happens sooner than later, because he's a busy guy. So there's a lot of times where I wanted really bad to be dependent on my sponsor, and he just wasn't around. It was me and God. Me and God. And he had known that I was, you know, prey to this whole knowledge gig, and, you know, he wasn't going to work with me that way. He's like, you know, I want you to have an experience with God, not an experience with the work, and not an experience with knowledge, and not an experience with the book, but an experience with God. You know, let's, you know, last, I remember so clearly, he looked at me and he said, knowledge you have, it's power you lack. Let's get you some power. So, you know, we started on the steps, and he had me writing, and we were flying through the work. And when I had originally, the first time I went through the work, I had a lot of expectations on the work. Actually, when I was, like, going to those meetings, and I remember they used to read the 9-step promises, which, you know, a lot of meetings read as the promises. I remember when I left AA the first time, when the first time I resigned from AA. I said, well, AA doesn't work because those promises didn't come true in my life. And I never knew that those were the 9-step promises. No one ever told me that. For those promises to come true, you have to do the work to get up to 9. And I had never done it, so there you go. When I went through the work and did my 3rd step, my 5th step, I had all these expectations on what it was going to feel like, what it was going to look like, what was going to happen, and it didn't. You know, I heard these people that were getting on their knees and doing the 3rd step prayer and having these white light burning bush experiences. I didn't. I remember after doing my first 5th step, I held really tight to those 5th step promises. And I expected them all to come true when I'm driving home in my car that night. And they didn't. And I copped a huge resentment against my sponsor at the time. Well, she didn't do it right, and now, you know, whatever. But again, I was looking to get fixed. You know, my God doesn't show up for me that way. You know, my sponsor and I was like, okay, so you have God, like, on a reward system. I expect God to fix me. You know, if I do this, he'll do this. You know, it doesn't work for me that way today. When I went through the work with my current sponsor, I had absolutely no expectations. None. When I got off my knees in the 3rd step, I didn't care what I felt like, what it looked like, I just kept going. You know, after my 5th step, you know, I just kept going. 6 and 7 kept going, 8 and 9 kept going. I got through my amends, and my amends process was amazing. Amazing. You know, I made some of the hardest amends that I had no intention of ever making. The amends that I showed up with the most fear were absolutely the most mind-blowing experiences I've ever had in recovery. There was one time where, I can't even read my watch. There was one time where one of my amends was to my mother-in-law. And I was in full fear, never wanted to make this amends. We didn't have a great relationship, and all of a sudden I found out she was showing up at my house that day. Full fear. You know, getting on the phone with my sponsor. Sponsor's not available. I went down at least 6-7 numbers. Nobody answered their phone. Again, me and God. And then, you know, I knew that time was there. It was just me and God. And I just prayed. I asked God to remove the fear and direct my attention to what he would have me be. She showed up, I made the approach, and what ensued was amazing. You know, I never, as it says in her book, I never lead with the spiritual stuff. I don't talk about God unless I'm asked. And, you know, she started asking me. And, you know, what are you doing, and why are you doing this, and what's going on? And she knew, I mean, her son was in that, she had 2 sons that were alcoholics, so she knows about AA a little bit, but obviously no one's ever made amends to her before. So she started asking me a whole lot of questions about God and what I was doing. And at this point, I'm really hard into meditation and prayer, and I've got this practice, and I'll talk about that in a bit. But this woman hates God. huge resentments against God for what she believes he has done to her in her life, and she has had a very, very, very difficult life from a young age in a, you know, in camps in Europe, and horrific life. But she was, you know, asking me all this stuff about God, and all I could share her with her was my experience. I know I don't try to convince anybody, you know, to join me and my God and whatever it is, and have your own experience, but this is what I do, and this is what it's done for me. And we were talking for hours, and at 11 o'clock that night, we're sitting on the floor in my living room, and I'm teaching her how to meditate. So it was this very, very, very powerful. This woman I had no relationship with, all of a sudden, you know, we're brought together by God. Very powerful in my life. So I cleaned up all the amends that I'm currently aware of, and, you know, very diligent 10-step process I have. But like I said, I mean, I wrote inventory today, shared it with my sponsor, who directed me to write even more inventory. But that's the way I live my life today. As a result of the 10th and 11th step, first time in my life that I've ever been able to say the words that I'm grateful to be an alcoholic. Because the 10th and 11th step give me tools to live my life every day. Not in relief, but in freedom and in peace. And what a magnificent way to live. My God, it brings me tears. It's such a gift, this program, and what it's done for me on a daily basis. I don't expect it to make me perfect, and I don't expect, you know, I'm human, and I have a human existence. I still experience resentment, anger, fear, all this stuff, but I don't live that way anymore because the 10th step gives me tools to get rid of this stuff immediately. And how freeing is that? You know, this anger over my injury, you know, it's not a big deal. I write inventory, I share it, you know, do this, I'm like, fine. You know, I don't walk around pissed off and angry and, you know, resentful and in fear anymore. Like I said, it crops up, but I have tools today. And it's miraculous how this program has changed the way I live my life. It's truly a way of life for me. It's not just about sitting in these rooms or going to meetings. It's about having a profound alteration in my reaction to life. You know, life can throw anything at me today, and I have a way to deal with it. Doesn't mean I always like it. I mean, I hate that I'm injured. I hate it. But it is what it is. You know, God's thrown a lot of stuff at me, and like I said, whatever he brings me to, he will bring me through. And every experience I've had that's been uncomfortable in recovery, I've come out the other side better for it. So I have this faith. Okay, you know, God, my knee's gone. My knee's shot. I can't do this. But okay, wherever I'm going to go as a result of this is better than where I was before I started. And I have certain faith in that today. No doubt in that. Doesn't mean I like being injured, but I'm almost excited now about where it's going to bring me. And it gives me new experience with which to help other women, which is always great. And one other thing I'm going to share about 10 Step is I have this tendency, you know, I can write resentment inventory and get, you know, pretty quickly to the fourth column, which is my, you know, my part in all of this. Selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, and afraid. And I can usually see my part in every resentment pretty quickly. So, you know, my ego crops back up and says, well, I don't really need to share anybody, you know, share this with anybody because I see it. You know, and again, my thinking mind is solving my own problem. I'm trying to solve a problem with the same mind that created it. Not good. So, from my experience, whenever I've called people with a 10-step inventory, they have always gotten me to see the truth that I could not see. Even when I thought I got to it, they would always see something different. So, you know, when it says in our book that we call somebody immediately, I do that now. Sometimes the inventory can wait a couple days, but sometimes there is immediately. And my sponsor taught me I have this network of immediately. I have three people in my life that if I call them and I say I have an immediately, they listen. And I do the same for them. You know, because why should I wait till the end of the night to write inventory and walk around in pain and fear and angry all day? You know, I can write a 10-step inventory at 10 o'clock in the morning, call one of my immediately, and it's gone by 10:15. And what a gift that is. So, I have a very disciplined 11-step practice in my life today, which I never, ever had before. I didn't know what meditation was. I would pray when I needed to. Not every day. I always heard 10-11s were maintenance steps, yada, yada. We hear that all the time, but maintenance doesn't work for alcoholics like me. I've tried maintenance most of my life, maintenance AA, maintenance drugs, maintenance drinking. Maintenance spirituality doesn't work for me. I'm either going up the escalator or down. I don't do well treading water. So I follow the book. I try to grow in understanding and effectiveness constantly. I try to improve my conscious contact with God. And I seek experience with God in any possible way that I can. I have gone to a whole host of things. I mean, I was raised Catholic, and I've gone back to the Catholic Church. I enrolled my son in CCD. I don't go, you know, I've gone back just out of curiosity, just to see if that's something that fits for me today or not. You know, I've also gone to other denominations to see if that fits better. I've gone to Quaker meetings. And I got to tell you, it's unbelievably cool. I know it sounds bizarre, and I expected to walk in and see, like, the pilgrim hats and the buckle shoes. But Quaker meetings are these silent meditations on God. And it's, like, the most powerful thing I've ever seen. It's, like, just these bunch of, there's no priest, there's no deity, there's no praying. It's just these silent meditations on God. So what I've been moved to do is seek experience with God and not seek knowledge anymore. And like I said, I'll go anywhere. I'll go anywhere and do anything if I think it's going to, you know, benefit me or others in this program and enrich my spiritual life. I didn't know how to meditate. My sponsor's big on meditation, and he showed me how to do it. Basically, how to sit, you know, correct posture and breath, and started me with 2 minutes on a timer. 2 minutes twice a day on a timer. And I did it. I did anything this guy said. And 2 minutes turned into three, turned into five, turned into eight, turned into, you know, no timer anymore. And I started sitting with different meditation groups and following other things, and it's taken me to a whole new place. I have come to learn that in discipline there is great freedom. Instead of praying when I get around to it or sitting in meditation when I get around to it, I have a very disciplined spiritual life, and I do it every day. No matter what's happening, I have this time. And for some reason, you know, if my kid gets up and screaming and I can't do it first thing in the morning, I do it when I can. But I never not do it. It's just part of who I am today. And what that's given me, this practice of meditation, is a sense of peace that I have never, ever had in my life. And meditation for me is not about, you know, however long it is that I'm sitting on my cushion, which I can't do anymore, so that's changed a little bit. But I can meditate anywhere. You know, it doesn't have to be the half hour or whatever, you know, that I'm sitting there or sitting with my group or whatever. I practice it when I'm standing in the grocery line. I practice it when I'm driving in traffic. You know, I'm standing in the grocery line, there's a kid in front of me screaming, and I'm late and I'm getting impatient, and literally I just go back to breath. I don't close my eyes, I don't levitate, any of that. It's just about going inside to that place of peace that's always been there and is within every single person here. It's going back home to me. And it's that place of bliss and silence and peace that we're all born with. But through years of, you know, piling all this crap on top of it, we're completely blocked from it. And that peace, you know, to me is the power of God, which resides, you know, not out there anymore. My God was always out there, and that's not true for me today. I believe, you know, my God and that power is within me as it is with every single person that I come across. Whether it's a junkie under the bridge tonight who may be my sponsor one day, you know, or my son. My son has become my greatest teacher in sobriety. I can't even tell you the power that my son has had. I thought I was put in this world I've been put in this world to play the role that God assigns, which is my son's mother. But I have come to learn that my son has been placed in my life to help heal me. And he has said some things to me and brought me some places that just floor me. Recently and in the past, and, you know, there's times I'm dry. And I've taught my son to meditate and talk about God, and I have no idea what time it is. I can't read my watch. Thank you. Driving in my car one day, and I asked my son, who's eight, and I said to him, Jack, what do you want me to make you for lunch today? And he looked at me, he's like, Mommy, I don't know, I'm living in the moment. That's my son. He keeps me present, and he keeps me grounded. My son was robbed of a mom for a lot of years. And with my injury, just 2 days ago, we're driving in my car, driving him home from camp, and he's like, Mommy, how's your knee? How's your knee, Mommy? And I said, you know what, Jack, it's okay. I have no pain, but I'm just angry. I'm angry at my knee. And he looks at me and goes, Mommy, don't be angry at your knee. You should be lucky you have a knee. If you didn't have any knees, then you couldn't walk. So my son has been a great teacher for me. And one of the greatest gifts I have been given in sobriety is to be a present mom for my son. Sobriety has enabled me to be the person I've always wanted to be. You know, I sponsor a lot of women, and a lot of women will say to me, I just want to go back to that person I was before I ever, you know, used alcohol or used drugs or whatever it is. And I just say, no, you don't. If you're anything like me, that person is the person that needed to get loaded every day to get by in life. And if you want to go back to that person, you're going to be miserable. One of the promises in the doctor's opinion, which is my favorite chapter, says that, you know, we get to recreate our lives. And the first time I was brought through the book and I saw that, I was just lit up because my life sucked, you know. And I was given the opportunity to recreate my life. I would never go back to that person I was, ever. You know, God willing, I never have to, because I've been given a life beyond my wildest dreams today. You know, externally, my life is worse than it's ever been. You know, I used to have a lot of money and a lot of stuff. I have nothing today. And I've never been happier. It's very bizarre how that works out. Internally, my life has changed. You know, having had a spiritual experience, I had a profound alteration in the way I live my life. And the cool thing about AA is how it affects everybody around us. As we get better, so does the family. You know, there was a time where I was getting spun out for a week or so about something, and as I was getting spun out, I saw my family spinning out. My kid was acting out, my husband was getting short. And when I'm able to stay on this path and stay connected to this peace, this stillness, which is God, the more I'm connected to God and can walk in peace, the more peaceful my family is and the more sane my family is. So the way we live our lives has a profound impact on everybody around us. And I've learned that the good way and the bad way. You know, I just want to close with, alcohol was never my problem. Alcohol was always my solution. And I am forever grateful to these rooms for giving me this solution. Oh, and I just want to read one thing before I'm done. And I think, yeah. See, now my left knee is killing me from standing up here. I didn't even know it. Our faith must be alive. It cannot be just a set of rigid beliefs and notions. Our faith must evolve every day and bring us joy, peace, freedom, and love. Faith implies practice, living our daily life in mindfulness. Some people think that prayer or meditation involves only our minds or our hearts, but we also have to pray with our bodies, with our actions in the world. If we live this way, we will have deep understanding and pure action, and we will do our share to help create a more peaceful world for our children and all the children of God. Thanks so much for having me.